Hi, everyone. Welcome to the first ever interview cover story in Mass. So welcome to Volume 7, Issue 6 for June 2023. Today, Eric Helms and I, my fellow Mass reviewer, are here with Matt Gary. Matt, how's it going?
Outstanding. Thank you so much for having me.
So we're going to introduce Matt in a little bit more in just a moment, but it is just such a pleasure to have him here. And the reason that Matt is here today is because we're going to focus this cover story on attempt selection in powerlifting. Also in this issue, Dr. Helms reviewed a paper titled Analysis of Competition Performance Leading to Success at the International Powerlifting Federation World Championships between 2013 and 2019. Now, this paper, as the title suggests, analyzed data looking at what factors were related in terms of attempt selection to winning competitions at IPF Worlds, Raw Worlds, that is, maybe not placing so well, and so forth. Now, Matt Gary is here because, in my opinion, he is somebody that I admire a great deal. He taught me almost everything I know about powerlifting, and he is the world's foremost expert, in my opinion, in attempt selection in powerlifting. And a lot of what he's been saying was looked at in this scientific publication. And Matt has been saying this ever since I've met him about 15 years ago, and I'm sure well before that. So it was a pleasure to see it come out. And as soon as Eric and I saw this paper, we said, we got to get Matt in Mass, and then to think, hey, we got to make it the cover story. This is not something that people should miss now that this paper's come out, and for Matt to be able to not only talk about some of the data, but talk about his experience, what he does in the trenches, what he's learned over the years. So it's absolute pleasure. So with that said, Matt, before we really get into the first couple questions and we analyze attempt selection and hear from you, just for those that aren't familiar, can you give us a background just on yourself, your experience in powerlifting and strength and conditioning, the facilities you've worked in and owned, and how many lifters you've coached over the years? Your experience is so vast. But if you give us some background on that, that would be fantastic.
Okay. Thank you both again for having me. It's quite an honor to be featured and just to collaborate with you guys on this topic that I'm so passionate about. So I really appreciate it. I'll try to keep kind of the introduction into my background kind of specific to powerlifting so that I don't over talk. But I was first introduced to the sport of powerlifting in 1982. So I was, that kind of dates me. I was only 10 years old at the time. Our new football coach came from the ADFPA, which stands for American Drug Free Powerlifting Association, which for those of you who might be reading this, realize that that was USA Powerlifting before USA Powerlifting became a thing. So that was when I was first introduced to powerlifting, was when I was 10 years old. And my football coach, he said, look, he said, I've got something that can help you become bigger and stronger, and that's going to translate to your performance on the football field. And as a 10-year-old, I'm like, hey, man, you had me at bigger and stronger. So I'd literally, you know, I wanted to be a better football player, but I figured, hey, if I could become bigger and stronger, that would be a win. So I squatted with him for the very first time on the very first day. And the next morning woke up and could literally not get out of bed. And that's not exaggerating. I had never experienced in my entire life muscle soreness like that in my legs. And it was not something that he warned me about. So I was like appalled. I literally had thought that I had done something wrong and was really scared into quitting and saying, you know what, I'm never going to do this again. I don't want to do this again. And for whatever reason, he didn't tell me that, hey, this, you know, muscle soreness is kind of comes with the territory, so to speak, especially in your first application of such endeavor. And so if we then kind of fast forward through high school and so forth, I went to Baylor University in Texas, and I walked on the football team there and eventually earned, you know, a partial scholarship. But my strength and conditioning coach there turned me on to the squat, bench, and deadlift as a means of getting stronger for and improving sports performance. And so I ultimately ended up transferring back from Baylor University to the University of Maryland, killing two birds with one stone, which was getting out of Waco, Texas, and then getting back to the University of Maryland, where I could then study kinesiology. So I started studying kinesiology and ultimately got my degree from the University of Maryland in kinesiology, graduating in 1994. And in and around that time, I was training at the University of Maryland, training like a powerlifter, doing squats, benches, and deadlifts, and learned about a facility that was only about 2 miles away from the university called Maryland Athletic Club. And that was where legendary Kirk Karwoski and my future wife was Suzanne Hartwig Gary, they were training at the time. And lo and behold, I had no idea that this powerlifting mecca was literally in my backyard. And so I started training there and continued to train like a powerlifter and now in and around and with other powerlifters. And I started competing in 1995. So that was kind of my first, you know, I got exposed to an actual gym where people train like powerlifters and immersed myself that way in training alongside these legendary lifters. And then didn't ultimately get my first exposure to international level competition until 2003. And I think kind of our conversation can kind of morph into some of that as we go, but that's kind of my background in terms of powerlifting. I've done some strength and conditioning. Obviously, I've interned at the University of Maryland. I also interned with the Washington Redskins strength and conditioning staff back in 2007. And so I was the strength and conditioning coach in 1995 at DeMatha Catholic High School in Hyattsville, Maryland, which is a nationally renowned private school that is, you know, nationally contending in football and basketball every single year. And so I had the great privilege and honor of working with them and being their strength and conditioning coach. But that should hopefully kind of tie a ribbon around some of my background and how I got into the sport.
Yeah, it's wonderful and interesting to hear all that. It's, you know, you mentioned DeMatha, which is a very famous, especially for the basketball program. But you know a lot of these places, and I do, Matt, because we went to the same high school. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Bullis.
Yep, we went to the Bullis School, and you know, right around the time that you were graduating high school, I think Helms just finished college at that time, you know, he may not be familiar with a lot of the same references being from a different generation. But yeah, you and I went to the same high school there. And that kind of leads me into a little bit as we get into it here, Matt. You know, I met you in 2009, I believe. We spoke on the phone a year or two before that. You probably don't remember. I was actually the strength and conditioning coach at Bullis. And I called you. I asked somebody at Rockville Fitness about barbells. And so I was looking to get one for the gym, and they said, I don't know, but you got to call Matt Gary. And I didn't know you at the time. I called you up. You gave me some recommendations. But I met you in 2009. One of my favorite days of powerlifting ever. Came back for the Maryland, USAPL Maryland States. I was living in Tallahassee, Florida, and there was a blizzard, and the meet was canceled. And you had a blizzard meet for those that could make it. I was staying with my parents, and I made it out to the gym. That was a phenomenal day. That video, I think, exists on YouTube. And at that time, you started talking about attempt selection. I remember you asking me what I was going to open within the meet. And I had some numbers, and you were watching me lift, and I could just see the look on your face. Like, this guy doesn't get it yet. This guy doesn't get it. And that was a very enlightening day for me. And then I went home, and later that day or within a few weeks, I read your article, which I still read and reference and send to people to this day, which was written in 2009 on the Maryland Powerlifting website. And that article was on attempt selection. And the paper that Eric reviewed in this issue of Mass, which if you haven't read that article yet, I would go check out the written text. But that paper Eric reviewed, it's amazing all these years later that you nailed it in that 2009 article. You were right on the money with what the scientific data is now showing. And this is a long time ago. So can you just give us your, before we get into too many specifics, your general overarching theory on attempt selection and how you came about these thoughts? Was it through just theory? Was it through practice and competing or coaching? But what's your overall theory on attempt selection that you wrote about in this article? And then what, you know, how was the way that you kind of came about these theories?
Yeah, so, yeah, we'll start with the overarching theory. I mean, you have to understand that the look at a competition and look at what is the goal of the competition. So in a powerlifting competition, matter-of-factly, the goal is to achieve your biggest or heaviest total possible. And matter-of-factly, the best way to do that is by making as many lifts as possible. Because powerlifters are afforded 9 total attempts, and that's only 3 per discipline, it stands to reason that the probability of building a larger total increases with the number of successful lifts. And that's how it works out. So if you can step away from strength for just a moment and kind of equate kilos lifted to points scored, then the lifter with the most points at the end of the day is the winner. And so the overarching theory or goal of attempt selection is to set your lifter up and to increase the probability of his or her success. And you do that by making more lifts. So making 9 out of 9 is better than 8 out of 9, and it's better than 7, and so on and so forth. And so I think this came to, or I came to that realization just through coaching and through serving. I served as an assistant coach. I said my first exposure to international competition was 2003 at the IPF Open Worlds in Chicago. That was the Equipped Worlds at the time. I was dating my now wife, Susie Hartwee Gary. She asked me to come along with her, and I traveled to the World Championships, and I became her personal handler that day, and literally just went into the warm-up room, realized, holy smokes, I am completely out of my element here. Let me obviously defer to the national team head coach, which at the time was Dr. Larry Maley, who is also the USA Powerlifting president. And so he would ultimately become my mentor and my teacher, if you will. And so I served, that day as a handler, and then I wound up helping the rest of that week. And that was my first exposure to international competition. And ultimately, every time that Susie would make a team, Larry would then invite me back as his assistant. And so I was immersed as an assistant coach on 5 national teams from 2003 to 2008 until I received my first head coaching position for the NAPF team in 2008. And so those 5 years were really formative in shaping my perspective on game day coaching and strategic attempt selection, because I'm shadowing my mentor the entire time, Larry, as he coached. And then my thinking shifted from seeing competition as a test day, as this strength exhibition, as a max out day, to understanding how to build a total and win even when our lifter wasn't the strongest. And so that literally just, I thought that it was a foregone conclusion that the strongest lifters would just always win and that the weaker opponents had no chance. And so I experienced this paradigm shift and was fascinated at how a weaker lifter could somehow, through strategic attempt selection, beat somebody who was clearly stronger. And so that was literally and figuratively the moment when it became clear to me that powerlifting was truly a game, a sport with strategy, and no longer just an exhibition of lifters, showcasing feats of strength. And so that was around the time that I began to do this deep dive into gathering data, into looking at the statistics from powerlifting competitions and through the years. And part of that article, that you mentioned discusses, to date, I've looked at over 17,000 individual performances from 112 competitions, starting in 2000, because that's about the time that the data is reliable and verifiable. When you go back before 2000, the results are kind of sketchy and you get these incomplete meet results and so forth. So in 2000, and I've looked at for the past 22 years up through 2022, that's about the time that I stopped collecting the data. So 112 competitions over 22 years, and I collected all this data, which I'm sure we can discuss, throughout our conversation today. But I found that the world champions at IPF World Championships were averaging 7.4 successful attempts out of 9. So that's about an 82% success rate. So the best of the best are averaging about 7.5 attempts out of 9. So they're making at least 1/3 attempt, per discipline, pouring into their total. And so anyway, just matter of factly, that's kind of how I came to that realization that it's truly a sport with strategy. And nowadays, I mean, that's never been more true than ever, right? Because the talent pool is rising. It's getting deeper and deeper. And so you're not going to get these one-off lifters. I mean, you still will see them occasionally, but it's become more rare that can go into a competition and win on 4 or 5 attempts. I mean, you've got to use all the bullets in your gut and make 8 or 9 lifts if you want a chance at being the top of the podium at the end of the day.
Well said, Matt. And I think that's a really great intro that aligns exactly with what the findings of the paper that I reviewed in this issue of Mass also reported. And it's good. I think now with that background on who you are, how you came to these conclusions, your overarching theory, and the actual data collection that you've done, which, by the way, isn't too dissimilar to what has actually been done in the peer-reviewed literature, we can actually get into the specifics. And before we do, I just want to say that my coaching philosophy before I met you and Mike in the same place in 2013 in Australia when I first became aware of who you were, and then started paying a lot of attention to things you had to say from that point on because I was so impressed, fundamentally changed how I do platform coaching. And I had the privilege and opportunity to see that in person as an assistant to you with Bryce at two different world championships. And from that point on, I wouldn't even say I became a better platform coach. I got the opportunity to be a good platform coach because I actually had a pathway that made sense. So all credit due there. And now to get into the specifics, let's start with the first thing that a lifter has to do, and that's their opener. So what would you suggest that a lifter use as their opener? What's the underlying recommendation based upon? And when does it differ? I would imagine, you know, if someone is cutting weight, and they have squat first, it might be a little different than their bench press. So talk to me about the nuances of first attempt selection and what you generally advise someone put on the bar for their first attempt.
Yeah, so when I started looking at the statistics, I matter-of-factly wanted to try to tie some real world numbers, you know? So I started looking at the data and trying to find out where people who are successful with their third attempts, you know, where are they opening relative to their third attempt and relative to their max, if I know what their max is and so forth. And so what the data reveal is that an opener typically is going to be somewhere between 90 to 92% 1RM. And I find that our sweet spot or the number that I kind of like to use is right in the middle, about 91%. For most people, you know, that's going to be somewhere around your best triple. So it's whatever you can do for three reps to competition standard. So that's a good place, particularly for a novice to start. If they don't know or have or ever tested a true 1RM, is take whatever you can get as your best triple to competition standard. And that matter-of-factly usually translates to a safe place to open, regardless of discipline. As you become more experienced, higher level, really elite level lifters, you could probably use their best double, and that might translate to a safe place. But of course, by then, they probably have tested their maxes so many times and know where their true 1RM is. So once again, kind of that sweet spot is right around circa 91%. What we have found is there's not a whole lot of variability between disciplines, other than maybe in the bench press. You could probably open just a touch heavier in the bench press because the jumps tend to be a little bit stronger. There's less absolute load on the bar typically, unless you're talking about some of these elite level one-off, you know, bench specialists. So then you might open as high as 92%. To your point, Eric, sometimes lifters would be wise to perhaps open just a little bit lighter in the squat or at the lower end of that range because, first of all, it's the first lift of the day, and there's usually some anxiety and some built-in stress associated with the fact that, hey, this is the first lift of the day, and so the nerves are kind of kicking in and so forth. And then also with the deadlift, the rationale might be, hey, this is the final event. Let me take just a pinch off the first one to preserve energy for that all-important third that I'm going to need. But typically speaking, other than that, most of the openers, again, tend to kind of hover right around 91%. And that seems to be a nice jumping off point that gets you into the meet safely. It's something that you can hit to competition standard. It's quote unquote heavy, you know, because it's above 90%, but it's not a weight that, anybody should really have fear of missing, particularly if they can perform that, you know, for 2 to 3 good quality reps to competition standard.
Hey, Matt, what would you say to somebody that said to you, hey, okay, my best triple though, but that's a little bit light. I can do that for three. Why am I doing that for one? I'm going to go a little bit more. What's your response to them, in terms of, yeah, I'm going to go, you know, something I can, you know, a 9.5 RPE ish, maybe a 9. I could maybe do one more, but that's a little bit light.
So I would try to talk them off the ledge, and tell them matter-of-factly that as we add load, as we increase intensity to the bar, there is less wiggle room. There's less margin of error. You need to dot every I and cross every T, so to speak, as we do this. So the goal of the first one is not to win the competition. It's to literally just put points on the board to get into the competition, to guarantee, hey, okay, I've hit my first one. Now I can secure a total, you know, versus when you miss an opening attempt, now your back is against the wall. Now you're adding this unnecessary stress upon yourself. And look, momentum in powerlifting competition is going to build positively or it's going to build negatively. So, you know, as our good friend and colleague Mike Tushier always likes to say, is let's build momentum. And so you want to build positive momentum, and that's what an opener does. So I would matter-of-factly try to talk the lifter off of the ledge and say, look, man, we're just trying to get you in the meat and just try to build some forward progress. And that then creates a good jumping-off point to get to the second attempt.
I think that's, you know, a phenomenal way to look at it. And something that, you know, I didn't really think too much of, you know, we've joked about before, well, why don't I just open with my PR? I have three chances at it, right? And, but the thing I think people need to keep in mind with this is if you go a little bit heavier, the chances of you missing it increase. The chances of you getting a little nervous if you're not feeling great that day, all of a sudden 95% is a lot closer to 100%. And if you miss that, that's a lot of fatigue from missing a lift. It's a lot different than a snatch. If you miss it, it's, you know, there isn't that eccentric component to it. You might get it on the next one. If you miss that, especially due to strength, you're going to be in rough shape. And then like Matt said, you quote, bomb out of the meat if you miss that one. So it's not really about the most, it's a stepping stone really to put yourself in the best position to lift the most when you can later on. And as you said, not all the strongest individuals win the competition, and if they make that mistake and you hit your opener, hey, you could slide right in there you know, with something. So with that said, even though the opener shouldn't be a problem, let's say somebody misses it, right? And maybe they miss it for strength, maybe they miss it because they miss a command. Whatever it might be, if that happens and they miss an opener, what would you recommend? Does that affect how your strategy is after that, or do you still move on ahead?
So let's start by laying just one simple ground rule. If your lifter misses the opener on strength, we're obviously going to repeat that attempt, right? I can't think of any scenario where if an opener was missed on strength, why you would want to therefore increase the attempt. That doesn't make any sense. So we can kind of get that out of the way. Now, the answer to the remainder of your question is situationally based. It's going to be based on the lifter's experience. It's going to be based on their goals and objectives for the day, and naturally based upon the level of competition. So to your point, you know, if a novice misses their opening attempt, particularly if it's a first-time novice, if this is their very first competition, I would say the vast majority of the time, we are going to repeat the attempt unless it's something that they absolutely blew out of the water, and then they missed it on something silly like a rack command. They were just over anxious, you know, like an opening squat. They just destroyed the squat. They were plenty deep. They went to competition standard. They did all the right things, but then they rushed into the rack or something of that nature. So, and I would just back up just a bit and say, and I don't say this to sound self-righteous or holier than thou, but that's also incumbent upon the coach to practice these commands in competition with the lifter, right? So, you know, one of the biggest compliments that our lifters get, our novices that we work with, is that we'll have people come out of the audience and look at them and realize that this was their first time and compliment us by saying, your lifters look like the most polished lifters and the most seasoned veteran lifters here on the day because they obeyed all the commands. They had crisp and clean walkouts and they executed to standard. And that, so there's some groundwork that the coaches need to do before the competition. But having said that, like our discussion before we got on air today, you know, look, humans are fallible. We get nervous. We make mistakes and so forth. So in those particular situations where they miss on something like a rack command, then we might go ahead and move up to the second attempt. Or if we're a little bit uncertain, maybe we kind of go halfway between the opener and the second attempt and go somewhere there. With an experienced level lifter, it really does depend upon their objective and the level of the competition, and also their opponents. And what I mean by that is if you have an experienced level lifter, or you have, say, an intermediate level lifter who might be competing for the sake of hitting a qualifying total that day, so they're not necessarily concerned with where they're placing, they simply want to procure a total to qualify them to go to like a nationals or something, then maybe we might repeat the opener, take it again, or just have a small increase. But I'd like to give an example. At this past World Championships in 2022, in the 93-kilo class, We had Chance Mitchell competing for the United States of America, and Chance missed his opening squat on a technicality. I believe it had something to do with his hands not being entirely secured around the bar or something to that effect. So he had to replace the bar, and then he wound up missing his opener. And so he was stuck in a weight class where there were literally four or five lifters, any of which could have won that day. It was just going to come down to, you know, who made the most attempts and who was there kind of at the end, where if Chance repeated that attempt, he was essentially already just forfeiting, because by that point, he was going to potentially lose between 15 to 17 and a half kilos, which would be commensurate with the jumps that he would normally take based upon his strength level. So he and his coach, Arian Kamisi, wisely had already discussed this in prior deep planning, and they went ahead and went up to their second attempt anyway, because the strength was there. It moved really well. He just got caught in some weird kind of one-off technicality. So in those situations, at a very, very high level, where if you basically repeat your opener, you might as well be saying, you know, I have no chance of placing now, or I have no chance of first place. And when your objective, matter of factly, is to win, and you have the opportunity to win based on the data, based on your strength level, then in that case, you just go ahead. And of course, he's a more seasoned lifter as well. While that was his first world championships, it was not his first rodeo in terms of high-level competition. So at those particular instances, you know, you can give the benefit of the doubt to the lifter and say, hey, I know you're not going to make that same mistake twice. We feel comfortable about moving up with you. And so those are kind of some situational scenarios where one might stay with the opener with a first-time novice, you know, or something like that, or, you know, in the situation of an experienced lifter, go up.
And Chance went on to become world champion partially because of that decision. So it was probably the right call, I would say. The so-called proof is in the pudding. So I think that's really helpful. Now we're on the board. We're building that positive momentum. We've gotten the jitters out, especially on the squat. Maybe accounted for the fact that we had to cut weight and our strength was temporarily down while we're rehydrating. Second attempt time comes up. So what would you suggest for the second attempt? And then on top of that, are there times where the planned second needs to be adjusted based upon the first, or are these both so submaximal that they're just kind of set in stone? What are we looking at here? And does it change based upon which discipline we're in, squat, bench, or deadlift?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So once again, let's go back to the data first. What do the data say? And the data reveal that the second attempt is typically going to be somewhere between 95 to 97% RM. Again, like we said, our sweet spot for the opener was about 91%. My personal sweet spot, and what I've found anecdotally and over years of experience works best, is right around 96.5% for that second attempt. And I think what we have to understand as coaches and as competitors, but mainly as coaches, is that every single attempt is essentially a diagnostic tool for us, a diagnostic tool and a data point where the coach observes the lift in real time and then objectively, unemotionally, determines what does my lifter have left in the tank based on that data point, based on what I just saw. And so while 96.5% is our sweet spot, that comes with the understanding that we may go a little bit lighter if the opener doesn't move as planned, or it felt heavier, it was sluggish, or there was a technical abnormality that we experienced. Or we might end at the, you know, aim for the top end of that range around 97%, you know, if the opener absolutely flies and it's faster than we anticipated. However, I don't recommend going any heavier than 97% of RM on a second attempt, because oftentimes what that will do is, it's not as risk of missing, it's more that it'll deplete energy for the all-important third attempt. And so if you go heavier on the second attempt outside of that range, you're just matter-of-factly oftentimes using up too much gas in the tank. And situations can vary based upon the level of the meet. So for instance, let's say we're at a high-level meet and you have someone competing at a world championships where there are opportunities for individual event medals at world championships. You know, at worlds, you can get individual event medals. It's just not the overall medal. And so occasionally you may have a lifter that has really no chance at the end of the day of hitting a podium placing, but matter of factly, they're really good in one of the particular events, be it the squat or let's say even the deadlift or any of the events they're particularly good at. And so then you're strategically, you're not necessarily adhering so rigidly to these percentages as you are at that time interpreting the score sheet, playing the game in terms of potentially mass matching somebody's attempt or strategically positioning by the lifter so that they can achieve that goal of potentially getting an individual, you know, event medal. And so that's where, you know, you need to remain flexible and not so rigid, but just be willing to interpret what's going on in competition. And I'm sure we'll get into this later in our discussions, but that's where, you know, you start to strategically use lot number and world record chips and things to your advantage. And then, of course, in the deadlift, where it is matter-of-factly the last event, you know, your second and third attempts can change based upon what the rest of the field is doing. You know, if you're pretty far ahead, then maybe you're not adhering to percentages. You're matter-of-factly just trying to protect or preserve a lead, kind of pad your total, kind of stay ahead. You know, if you've got ground to make up in the deadlift and you've got somebody who's a prodigious deadlifter, then maybe you're slightly more aggressive and you go a little bit bigger. So those are kind of some examples about that second attempt and how it might change accordingly.
Matt, that, you know, but before we move on, I want to talk about the third attempt in a moment, but something that you said is something that we were going to touch on. I think this is a great opportunity to do so because it's going to come into play also kind of on the third attempt, and especially when we talk about the deadlift as well on the third attempt. So can you talk a little bit more about what you mean about lot number for those listening and how you can use that to your advantage and strategically be aware of what your lot number is?
Sure. So as powerlifting coaches, it is matter-of-factly our job to put our powerlifter, our athlete, in the best position to succeed. So at the beginning of the day, you are trying to leverage whatever you can to stack the deck, and I use cards as an example, to stack the deck in your favor. And so when your lifter gets weighed in, clearly you're looking at a bunch of things. You're not just looking at the amount of weight that you're lifting, but you're looking at what was their lot number. And so to answer your question right off the bat, Mike, for your readers, the lot number determines the order in which you weigh in, and more importantly, it determines the order of lifting when two people take the same attempt. So if Eric and I are competing against each other and we both call for 200 kilos in the squat, if Eric has the higher lot number, that means I have to go first. So he would have the advantage of seeing my attempt, you know, before he has to take his. And where that becomes all important is like you said, Mike, is in the deadlift. When matter-of-factly, at the end of the day, if two lifters are taking the same deadlift attempt, as a coach and as a lifter, you would get to see me go first. And so then you might know how to strategically base your attempts based off of my performance. So having that lot number advantage is something that becomes really, really valuable. You pretty much always want to have a higher lot number. The only advantage of having the lower lot number is if you've cut a tremendous amount of weight and you're really anxious to get weighed in and kind of start that rehydrating and refueling process. And also if you're a weaker deadlifter, because at the end of the day, the lot number is really not going to matter to you anyway. It doesn't matter that you have the best lot number if you can't outpull your opposition. So in those particular one-off scenarios or what have you, you know, the lot number might not mean anything to you, but in all other situations, it's better to have a higher lot number so that you can see what your competition is doing matter-of-factly. So that's just one of the ace cards that you quote-unquote kind of like to have up your sleeve, is having the higher lot number. Another ace card would be, of course, being the strongest powerlifter in the room. I mean, if you're matter-of-factly just the strongest lifter in the room, and you play your cards right, so to speak, since we're using that analogy, you're going to be tough to beat. And so if you have the highest ceiling, it's hard to trump that ceiling. Another ace card would be the strongest deadlifter, because the deadlift is the last event and you get to go last. So we talked about being the strongest powerlifter overall, the strongest deadlifter, having the higher lot number. Clearly having a lower body weight is an advantage, because if two lifters are competing in the same weight class and have the same total, then the lighter lifter wins. So if the lighter lifter is going at the end of the day, they might know, hey, all I need to do is tie this person on total, and by virtue of me being the lighter lifter, that increases my placing. And so I can go for the win in that way. And then, of course, the last final ace card. We've already used the four aces in the deck, so let's call it a joker card, if you will, would be having the opportunity to go for a record. So the typical increase in a powerlifting competition, or the minimal increase, is 2.5 kilos, which is 5.5 pounds, for those of you that prefer pounds. But if you're, so that is the absolute minimum increase. However, except if you're attempting a record, a national or international or world record, then you're allowed to go up by 0.5 kilos, which is 1.1 pounds. So we refer to that as having a chip advantage. The reason we call it chips is because these are the smaller discs that they use, that the weightlifting manufacturers manufacture, that go on the bar. So we call it, we use the expression chips on the bar. And so when they call for chips on the bar, you're allowed to go up by a smaller increment. So these are five different things that you are trying to matter-of-factly leverage and stack the deck in your favor that you'd like to play. And so if you have any of those cards to your advantage, you want to try to play each and every one of them, you know, as often as you can.
So you talked about second attempts, and then I was going to ask you about third attempts, and it was perfect that we got to talk about lot numbers right there. But in that last answer, to get to the third attempt question, you mentioned setting a record, you mentioned winning, and you talked about PRs. So when we go to third attempts from a second attempt, is it just all about, hey, what do I have left? What is the absolute most I can lift today? Is that always what you're going after for your third attempt? Or do those other things, the PR, the setting a record, and the winning, do they play into strategically how you're going to select a third attempt, and how would you go about it in each of those situations?
I think that's best answered by determining the level of the competition, the experience level of your lifter, and matter-of-factly, their objectives. So when you can answer those questions beforehand, that then gives you the keys to the kingdom in determining what those answers might be. So if you're working with novices or even intermediate-level lifters who are competing at the local level, at a state championships, let's say, or a provincial championships if they're competing in Canada or whatever their local competition may be, you know, matter-of-factly, I mean, look, the PB or the PR, the personal record as we call it in America, or the PB internationally, the personal best, that is the foundational thing that we're going after, right? Every single one of us wants to do something that we've never done before. And so going for that lifetime PR or PB is what we all crave so much. We want to lift things that we've never done before. So at these competitions where, quote unquote, the stakes don't necessarily matter, there's no real benefit or loss if you lose, then yeah, the PB or the personal record becomes matter-of-factly the goal. And so you're matter-of-factly aiming to do something that you've never done before. And so you are then kind of just observing, hey, what do I have left in the tank based on my second attempt? And so we don't really assign percentages to third attempts. Like I said, it's situationally based. And so if the second attempt moves well, and it feels good and the lifter's confident, then heck yeah, let's load it up and go for that incremental PB, that next 2.5 kilo increment above their current PR. And alternatively, if the second attempt was tough, if it was hard, if it was sluggish, if it didn't move well, if there was a decrement in performance, or you didn't uphold the standard of competition and you got a red light or something like that, then you're basically picking anywhere from wherever the second attempt was to potentially maybe tie PB or tie the PR. And so again, it's not really assigning percentages. It's just looking, hey, what do I have left in the tank? Now, when we're talking about lifters who are competing at national championships or world championships or these competitions that are based on formula where there's money involved, there's prizes, there are consequences of winning and losing, then, you know, we're really looking at putting our lifter in the best position to succeed. So yeah, if a PB is on the table, that's kind of lines up with what our goals are and everybody's feeling confident, then yeah, we're going to put up, there's good opportunity there that we're going to put a PB on the bar and go for it. But you know, like we talked about earlier, you might tend to be a little bit more conservative in the squat and the bench press, understanding that those are the first two events and there's still more to come. There are more events left because the logic in the squat might be, hey, we're trying to build the total here. And most powerlifters, unless you're, you know, kind of one of these one-off bench specialists, most powerlifters are building their total, matter-of-factly, through their third squat and their third deadlift. those are going to be the heaviest attempts of the meet. So in the squat, because it's the first event, it might be a little bit more advantageous to go for the number that you know you can get versus the one you want, right? Because it'll serve to build the total and also save that precious energy, particularly in the form of lower back fatigue for the third deadlift. In the bench press, because the loads tend to be absolutely less, it's more about holding serve, building the total, and let's not unnecessarily lose kilos. However, sometimes with lighter, smaller, weaker level lifters, or weaker lifters, I should say, sometimes the risk of getting the extra 2.5 kilos on a third bench is worth potentially losing 5 kilos. And sometimes it's not. So those kind of have to be weighed on the scales, so to speak, and taken, you know, into consideration with the coach. And then, of course, the third attempt at the deadlift, particularly at high-level competitions, nationals or higher, is all about positioning and potentially winning. And so I use the expression all the time, there's only one day out of the year when you can become a champion. And today is that day. So that being a national or a world champion, you can hit a PR or a PB 364 other days out of the year. So today is the day that we're setting you up for success and setting you up for positioning and becoming a champion. So if it means taking less than you wanted or less than a PB, but we know that it's going to secure your placing, secure the W, so to speak, or move you up a place or put you on the podium, then it's all strategically about positioning your lifter to do that.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I think sometimes lifters don't think about that, and that's why it's so valuable to have a coach that, I've got 10 more in me, coach, but you only need 5 to be a world champion. Well, what if I go 7.5? Well, if you miss, you're a silver medalist. So let's just think about what's at stake here, and let's think about this probabilistically rather than emotionally, which is a challenge to do when you're a lifter, which is why it's so good to have a rapport with a coach, and you have someone who can have a little more objectivity in that moment. So that makes a ton of sense. One minor follow-up question that kind of applies to potentially any second or third attempt is, would you ever have a lifter scratch an attempt to simply not come out for an attempt? Is there ever a reason to do that in your mind?
So if I give you a one-word answer, the one-word answer is rarely. But let's expand upon that. Lifters only get 9 opportunities to build the total or score points, as we've said. So scratching an attempt means we are essentially forfeiting approximately 11% of our scoring opportunities. Right. And so I would not intentionally want to forfeit 11% of my opportunities to score points. However, when the second attempt, particularly in the squat, looks like a limit lift for whatever reason, or it's an RPE 10 type lift, and you know, based upon your lifter's previous performances, he or she just doesn't have anything left in the tank, or they misgrooved it and they're not likely to come back and get it on their third, then yeah, it might be wise to scratch the third attempt where, you know, discretion is the better part of valor, as they say. And so we scratch that third to preserve and save energy because we've probably matter-of-factly gotten all the kilos we can get out of that lifter anyway. Occasionally, one caveat to that might become flight size. When you get stuck in a smaller flight and you've got a bigger, stronger lifter, you know, and the second attempt is really, really tough and you know, wow, man, there's a quick turnaround here. We're in a really small flight. You're not going to get your full complement of rest. It's going to come back to you pretty quickly. That might be another scenario. As I said, rarely are we going to forfeit or scratch a third attempt, but those might be some of the scenarios that I would consider. And then it's, you know, it's about knowing your lifter and having a conversation with them, you know, quickly, but also kind of building that into, having that baked into the game plan beforehand. And so it's incumbent upon lifter and coach to have these strategy game planning calls beforehand, particularly for these higher level competitions, so that we're all on the same page and that we matter-of-factly have the plays called so that we can call the play in the moment, objectively, unemotionally, during a time when the adrenaline is pumping and we're on a clock, when we have 60 seconds to get our next attempt in.
Matt, next I want to go to, you mentioned it right there, so I was going to ask this in a bit, but you talked about flight size, and just to continue on that discussion, what exactly, for those that aren't as familiar, with the powerlifting meet. What exactly do you mean by flight? And then can you talk about the size of the flight and how or if that may or may not affect your attempt selection strategy?
Yeah, so the term flight is just another, it's synonymous with group. It just means a group or a collection of lifters. And so meet directors and competition promoters will matter-of-factly organize these groups, these flights, as they call them, based on gender, based on weight class, and sometimes based on age for juniors, sub-juniors, master's level lifters, and so forth. And they will collect you in these groups. And so the minimum amount of lifters that you are allowed to have, and this is most federations, and I think for the purposes of our discussion here, IPF level competition and IPF affiliates, the minimum amount of lifters you can have in one group or flight is 6. The maximum is 14. And so in the rare case that you have fewer than 6 lifters in a flight, they build in what they called compensatory time to make it as though you had 6 lifters. So let's say you only have, let's say the 3 of us are competing in the same flight, and it's Eric, Mike, and Matt. There's 3 of us. They would set the clock for an additional three minutes to make it as if there were 6 lifters. Because you can typically assume, you know, each lifter has 1 minute once they call bars loaded to get their start command in the squat or the bench, or to make a bona fide attempt in the deadlift. You have 60 seconds to do those things. So typically an attempt takes, you can count, 1 minute per attempt per lifter. So the maximum amount of lifters, as I said, in a single flight is 14. And so small flights, naturally, with fewer lifters, tend to move quickly. And that might mandate a more conservative approach from coach and lifter, particularly if you're coaching larger, heavier, stronger lifters who create more of an oxygen debt, if you will, after each attempt. They use up more energy, they're breathing more heavily, they can't recover as quickly as a lighter lifter. Typically, lighter females can recover very quickly after maximum effort. They're ready to go again, whereas bigger, heavier lifters are going to take longer to recover. So a smaller flight might mandate a more conservative approach. Also, if we're talking about equipped powerlifting, where you're using squat suits, bench suits, knee wraps, and so on, that might mandate a more conservative approach as well if you're in a smaller flight, because you're having to accommodate getting your lifter ready with all of that equipment, wrapping their knees, pulling the straps up, these sorts of things, which induce additional fatigue on your lifter during the day. So those are situations. Flight size, you know, kind of the sweet spot, I think, for most people, they'd like to be in a flight with about 10 to 12 lifters. You know, that seems to be a good pace for most lifters, for most weight classes. You know, things do typically move a little bit faster than a minute per lifter, but it's nice to have, hey, like an 8 to 10 minute break between maximal exertions. And so to your point also, Mike, you have 60 seconds to submit your attempt after coming off the platform. So again, during that 1 minute time frame, you need to huddle up with your coach, have the game plan installed beforehand so that you know what you're looking at and you've got a range of numbers that you're going to hit. And so that discussion can be succinct. It can be, it needs to be objective from the position of the coach, unemotional, just based on the data point that lifter has given you. And then obviously you're going to get some feedback from the lifter in terms of how it felt. And then together you arrive at a number, but all that has to be done within the 60-second time frame so that you can submit your next attempt. Because if you don't get your attempt in on time, then if you have a successful attempt, they're going to take you up the absolute minimum, which is 2.5 kilos. And if you've missed the attempt for whatever reason and you don't submit it within 60 seconds, you are going to be forced to repeat that attempt.
Yep, that's all really valuable information. And one thing I want to rewind us back just a little bit is that a lot of the things we're discussing here is predicated on knowledge we have from training or from prior meets. So I guess the question I have is how can a coach or an athlete, if they're self-coached, intentionally use their training in a way to inform or even determine their planned attempts on game day? Does that mean they need to go through 1RM testing phases in their training? Should they be practicing their openers? Are we estimating 1RM from training? What do you recommend as far as using training as an informational tool to inform competition day attempt selection?
Yeah, so As powerlifting has become more popular, there have become more diverse approaches. And so, matter of factly, it really doesn't matter how the lifter has gotten strong and reached that level of preparedness. So regardless of your method or preferred style, it is imperative for that game day coach to review the lifter's heaviest training as a key first step, if you will, to installing that competition game plan. So with that in mind, there's satisfactory methods of determining attempts from the training data, and then there's better methods, in my opinion. So some coaches feel that E1RM, which is estimated one rep max, serves as this reliable proxy, if you will, for game day performance. I, matter of factly, do not share that sentiment. I think that estimated 1RM is an estimate, or it's a best guess, of a lifter's abilities on a specific training day. But they're not even guaranteed that day. They're not guaranteed tomorrow, 3 weeks from now, or at the competition. They're really not a predictive measurement at all. They are moments in time that allow us to compare to other training days. And so, you know, estimated 1RM can be calculated from the rating of perceived exertion. It can also be calculated based on various rep calculators. And so calculating your E1RM from RPE, it can be flawed because of the variability of the subjective rating used by the lifter. You know, he or she may inaccurately have assessed their performance. And then oftentimes, you know, as an example, females can often do more reps at a higher percentage of their 1RM, which tends to disrupt the estimations. So with all of that sort of thing said, and sometimes the rep calculators aren't as accurate either, you know, these higher rep sets become really misleading in terms of a lifter's 1RM capabilities. So this is where specificity comes into play, and specificity is important because, you know, what do we do on game day? Well, we do one rep maxes, or we do a single, you know, that is our set, if you will. So I prefer using bar speed, video feedback, and the coach's eye and acumen on singles that are 90% and above, or and are also performed to competition standard, obviously, and then at or near competition body weight. And it also matters in the discussion of the bench press and the deadlift is, were those lifts performed after a significant squat? Because if you tell me, I had a bench press PB today, coach, in training, I'm going to say that was fantastic. First question, did you squat first? Okay. And second question, were you on body weight? Because if you didn't squat first, then really it's an irrelevant data point in terms of unless you're competing in a bench press only competition where you bench first. Because in a real competition, you're going to have to squat first, and you're going to accumulate just this systemic or structural fatigue, if you will, holding a heavy bar across your back. And so that is going to fatigue your shoulders for the bench. And of course, your lower back for the deadlift. But also to answer your question, Eric, yes, openers should and can and probably ought to be practiced to instill training confidence and also to create reliability through verifiability. If you can verify, yes, my lifter is executing these singles circa 90 to 92%. Then this is, you know, to competition standard and they're at or near competition body weight, then this serves as a reliable and place for us to open on game day. And that's going to breed confidence with your lifter. So yeah, you'll see many power lifters now kind of during their taper week or just before their taper week as the start of their taper, they might matter of factly be going through their openers in each discipline, which serves to test as they get closer to competition body weight. Are these verifiable? Are they reliable? And are we on top form?
You know, one thing before I have the next question for you is you said that if somebody has a bench press PR, you would ask them if they had squatted first. I think you know you would never need to ask me if I squatted first. you also know that I haven't set a bench PR in 14 years. You know, you talk about that. One thing I remember, and I have a lot of anecdotes that I remember from training when Supreme Sports Performance and Training was in Rockville, Maryland. It was something that I looked forward to coming back once or twice a year. And it was very important to me to come back and train there and get to spend time with you and Susie. And I was warming up and Susie said to me, she was watching me warm up. And she said, you know, Mike, you only have so much gas in the tank. And I altered my warm-up strategies after that day of talking with her and having her critique what I was doing. And so can you talk a little bit about how you would warm up for your opener, but not only how you warm up for it? You know, so much of what we talked about today is you mentioned earlier about, you know, maybe opening with the triple, because one of the reasons is things are different on the competition or at competition day than they are in the gym. Well, when you have to warm up at a competition, it's not just you. There's two warm-up racks, maybe, and however many lifters. And so how would you warm up ideally? And then are there situations where, based on what's going on in the warm-up room, where you might have to alter your warm-up or you don't have enough time to get to a rack, how might you strategically change things to make sure you're ready, even if you can't get in everything you want to in the warm-up room?
So, there's a lot to unpack there. I think it starts with understanding that, you know, what are kind of these key components or the purpose, if you will, of warming up? Why do we warm up? Why don't we just walk out on the platform and throw our heaviest weight on the bar? And as a matter of factly, you know, we want to prepare the body for the impending loads and for, you know, what is to come, so to speak. So, you know, kind of these key components, if you will, of a typical warm-up are going to be some type of general warm-up to increase your heart rate and core temperature. You might be doing some mobility drills to increase range of motion and increase blood flow to the muscle. That might mean you're doing some dynamic stretching to lengthen the muscles and improve function and so forth. You might even implement some muscle activation to kind of prime some of the stabilizing muscles that have a role in supporting the prime movers. And then, of course, ultimately, there's going to be a barbell warm-up to prime the nervous system for these heavier weights. But I think what's really key and important here is understanding that on game day, it's a warm-up for essentially lifting a maximum or testing your strength level. It's not the warm-up for a workout. You know, it's not the warm-up for you know, this a 5x5 or 10 triples or 8 doubles or whatever it is. It's warm-up for you taking 3 ascending singles in theory. And so you matter-of-factly want to preserve as much energy and save as much gas in the tank as possible. And so while that might look slightly different based upon lifter preference and lifter feel and lifter strength level, typically, you know, most warm-ups in a powerlifting meet are going to be 3 reps or fewer, frankly. I mean, you might take the bar for a set of 8 to 10 just to kind of loosen up and stretch. And your first set might be 3 to 5 reps. But after that, you're probably looking at predominantly, you know, doubles, singles, maybe a triple here and there, kind of pyramiding up, if you will, to where you're doing singles at the end to prepare your body and your mind and your musculature and your connective tissue for these impending loads. And so what I have found anecdotally speaking is that most of the time, if we're going to have a lifter open, like I said, circa 91%, then we kind of look at where do they prefer taking their last warm-up? What is an appropriate load jump for them from the last warm-up to the opener? And once we can determine that number, we then count backward to the bar as opposed to just winging it and saying, well, we're going to start with the bar and just add reds, you know, each time. Well, that meant work for, you know, a Ray Williams or Jesus Olivares who's squatting a grand. You know, that's not going to work for most people. So you typically find out where's the last warm-up, and I have anecdotally found in my 28 years in the sport that for the squat and the deadlift, that typically falls right around 83% of maximum as a really good place to be if you're opening right around that 91% range. That seems to be an appropriate jump. For the bench press, it's a little bit higher. The last warm-up typically tends to be about 85%-ish. And give or take, don't get lost too much in the numbers. But once you find that last warm-up, you then count back to the bar, making sure that your jumps are incrementally sound, that you're not taking a small jump followed by a bigger one, that they are getting, you know, that they're either the same incrementally or they're getting slightly smaller as you approach your opener. And so those are some kind of rules of thumb in terms of warming up. And then to get to the point, Mike, in terms of, you know, realizing that you're not the only sand at the beach, so to speak. You have to share a warm-up room, share a rack with other lifters. You know, when you're at national championships or elite-level competition, international championships, there are going to be these lever-adjustable racks in the back at these higher-level competitions. And so But when you attend a local competition, you may not have any racks like that. You might be warming up out of a cage or off of a CrossFit rig or something like that, where the heights are not adjustable. So my recommendations, first of all, is as a coach, is to be assertive. Is understand that you are an advocate for your lifter. And so if you're in a warm-up room where there's limited space, you need to matter-of-factly advocate for your lifter. Try to pair up with lifters of similar strengths and similar heights. It just makes sense. Similar rack heights in the squat and the bench press. The deadlift, it doesn't matter as much. You just want to try to warm up with somebody who's around the same strength, so you're not changing from an 800-pound last warm-up to a 200-pound last warm-up. I mean, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Is try to strategically pair up with people like that. And a general recommendation would be to start early. If you have a lot of warm-ups, start your warm-up early. You can always slow down, but you're not going to be able to speed up without increasing anxiety and inducing additional fatigue on your lifter. And fatigue, you know, can be created from anxiety and from worry, from them thinking, hey, I'm not going to get all my warm-ups in. And so if you start early, then you should have enough time. And all that is to say is, look, if you have a lifter that's, you know, opening around 150 kilos, and that's 330 pounds in the squat, and they have listed 9 warm-ups, you know, you're going to have to probably shave off some of those warm-ups. Lifters at that strength level, I can't really think of anybody who's going to need 9 warm-ups to get to their opener. You need to strategically shave off a few of those warm-ups and have that warm-up make more sense. And again, that all comes with the understanding that in competition, you're now on the clock. You're going on somebody else's schedule. This isn't a workout where you can take 2.5 hours to warm up and get to your top weights. You're sharing racks, and you're on borrowed time, so to speak. And so those are some considerations that should all be taken into consider, you know, all go into consideration and discussion when formulating a warm-up strategy.
Matt, you specifically talked about how things can be quite different at high-level meets, sometimes for the better, sometimes for, I wouldn't say the worse, but certainly for a higher-pressure situation. And some of the things we talked about earlier, you talked about, you know, chip advantage, you talked about lot number. Let's dive into these a little deeper and talk about some of these lesser-known factors or things that are present in the rules that often never rear their head at local competitions because people are not and can't set national or international records, and they can't use that in a strategic way. The ability to take a 0.5 or any increment less than 2.5 or an increment between 2.5 and 5 provides potential advantages in certain circumstances. And also the fact that the deadlift is unique and you can change that attempt multiple times. Can you talk us through how these variables and their interaction can sometimes make a difference at higher level competitions and try to help the listener understand if they're ever in that situation where they're going to be coaching internationally or maybe they're just that strong where they should be aware of this type of thing?
Sure. I think the best way to kind of go through that is maybe to just give you a couple of examples. And so and we can elaborate on some of those. So I'll give you an example that comes from a high-level competition. It was 2017 IPF Classic Worlds in Belarus. My wife, Susie, was competing in the 52-kilo weight class. At the time, she was a world-class squatter, certainly a world-class powerlifter. But we understood based on the data that was before us that Susie was not going to be in the running for a podium spot. She was, in all likelihood, going to place probably 4th or 5th in a very competitive class. And so for us, it was all about securing an individual event medal for her, taking back the squat world record and getting the gold medal in the squat. Those were our objectives. And then beyond that, of course, per usual, going 9 for 9, representing yourself well. And look, if one of these other lifters slips up or trips up or only makes 6 or 7 lifts, then maybe Susie can sneak in and grab a podium spot. But matter of factly, the game within a game, if you will, became our approach to her trying to procure the gold medal in the squat. And so at the time, we had another prodigious squatter in the weight class, Liz Craven from Australia. And so Susie had been trading this world record back and forth with Liz for a couple of years, and they finally got to clash, you know, the clash of the squatting titans, so to speak, at Worlds, where they came together. And so this is where lot advantage, lot number advantage, and body weight becomes really critical. And then also using, so all three of these things were at play. Body weight, of course, lot number advantage, and then having chips to your advantage as well. And so Susie, matter of fact, was lighter than Liz, and we also had the lot number advantage. So we knew that, hey, Susie has the potential to see what Liz does, and then, you know, for her second attempt, and then the third one, we might be able to go after her. So anyway, as it unfolded, while Susie did have the lot number advantage, the higher lot number, Susie actually opened 2.5 kilos lighter than Liz. So Susie opened at 142.5, while Liz opened at 145. So Susie had to go first because she's lifting the lighter weight. And in powerlifting, it goes from the lightest lift up to the heaviest, and then the round starts over. So Susie went out first. They both secured their first attempts and hit them very well. They both called for 150 kilos on the second attempt. So what that means was Susie took a 7.5 kilo jump from 142.5 to 150, while Liz only took a 5 kilo jump. But what that meant, key and important for us, was the order would then change, because Liz had the lower lot number. She was then forced to take 150 kilos before Susie. So we had the advantage of seeing how Liz's second attempt looked. And then also, more importantly, once she came off after making her second attempt, which looked great, she came off the platform and we had the opportunity to see what she put in for her third attempt. And that's where the strategy really came in. So both ladies made the 150 kilo attempt. Like I said, Liz went first. Liz then submitted 156 kilos, which is a weird number. She held the world record at the time at 155.5. And so she submitted 156 for her third attempt. So strategically, because we had the lot number advantage, because we were going to go second, I intentionally called for the same attempt. And you say to yourself, well, why do you call for the same attempt if it's a world record? And here's the reason. Because by rule in competition, and this is what a lot of readers may not know, is that you can't have two people holding the same world record on an individual lift. So I went ahead and strategically called for 156 kilos, therefore matching Liz, because by rule, if Liz makes the 156 kilos, our attempt automatically gets chipped up an additional 0.5 to 156.5. If Liz misses the 156, then we stay at 156, and there's no reason for us to overexert ourselves and take more than is necessary. So I called for 156. Liz went out and hit the 156 kilos and breaking her own world record. And so momentarily she's holding this world record, the new world record, and momentarily gold medal position in the squat, while they automatically chipped Susie's attempt up to 156.5. And Susie went out and hit the 156.5 and took the world record back. And so by that point, it was mission accomplished. We got gold medal in the squat. We got Susie's world record back. And that was the start of a fantastic competition for her. Susie went on to go 9 for 9. She actually placed right where she thought she would place, which was 5th place. But she had an outstanding day, you know, of course, a world record in the squat, and it was just mission accomplished. So that's really, you know, an example of where all three of those factors that come into play. If we didn't have lot number advantage and so forth, then we would not have been afforded that opportunity to see what Liz did. But again, by rule, you automatically get chipped up to that higher weight. So that's kind of one of these examples where all three of those situations, you know, all three of these situations come into play. Later that week, also in Belarus, 2017, we had two 93-kilo lifters. We had Ellis McLean and Dave Ricks lifting in the 93-kilo class. And rather than go on this 30-minute explanation of what happened, I was coaching Ellis McLean. My wife, Susie, was coaching Dave Ricks. Out of integrity and fairness to the competitors, when you have two lifters that have the opportunity to place, you matter-of-factly need to split them and have different coaches, because you can't play chess against yourself. It wouldn't be fair for me to coach both Dave and LS. So we intentionally switched the coaching duties, or split the coaching duties, I should say. And while we did warm up together as a unit, as part of Team USA in the back, I was coaching LS. Susie was coaching Dave Ricks. And so anyway, with LS, who's kind of known as this subtotal lifter, who's good in the squat and good at benching, and, you know, not bad in the deadlift, but not as good as some of his other competitors. And we knew that we were going to be deadlifting before some of his other competitors. You know, you have to really kind of stack the deck in your favor by building the biggest total possible at subtotal. And so as it turned out, LS was actually in eighth place after squats. We regained some ground because, as you know, LS is a world-class bencher. He did wind up hitting three benches. And so we moved into second place after the bench press. After the opening deadlifts, we dropped back down to third. After second deadlifts, we were in fourth place. And then I'm confronted with this conundrum, if you will, where I have LS capable of deadlifting more. But I have to ensure at that point, because we are in fourth place going into the third deadlift, we do not have body weight advantage, we do not have lot number advantage, and we do not have any chip opportunities because deadlift is not his best event. So we can't go for a world record. So as a coach, I matter-of-factly have to put a number on the bar that I know that LS can make. It's a high probability make to build our total and force our competitors out of their comfort zone and force them to make their attempts. If we miss our third attempt, then we're in fourth place. We can do no better than fourth place. If we make our thirds, we then put pressure on our competitors. And as fate would have it, we went up. LS was not happy with the number that we took, but I put on a number that I knew that he could make because it was his feelings, quite frankly, didn't really mean too much to me at the time. Me ensuring a podium placing at that point in time was the objective because he was in fourth place. And anyway, as the story unfolded and as fate would have it, LS wound up winning that competition because he made his deadlift. His other competitors overestimated their abilities, and I was keen to watch them and watch their second attempts and knew that they were unlikely to make their thirds. And so I had to intentionally put on a number on the bar that I knew LS could make to force our competitors out of their comfort zone. They did. And I said, look, this guy is, his anger for me is soon going to be fade once he's standing atop of that podium and they're playing the national anthem. And so that was a good example of not having any of these kind of advantages really in our favor and just strategically selecting attempts to engineer victory, if you will. And then one of the last examples before I talk too long would be the 2019 USA Powerlifting Nationals with, of course, your lifter, Eric, Bryce Lewis, and going in a situation against Ashton Ruska, where matter-of-factly, on paper, when you just look at the sum of their PBs, Ashton's matter-of-factly the strongest guy in the room. And so you then have to leverage these things to your advantage. And so we knew at the time what we could leverage to our advantage because Bryce didn't really have any chip opportunities at any one of the individual events. And he was the heavier lifter because Ashton came in lighter at the time. The only advantage that we had was lot number. And through strategic attempt selection, we kind of outfoxed and outmaneuvered them where we made our second deadlift, and then I intentionally forced Ashton to take a lift that he did not need. He had to take more than he needed to win. And as it played out, Ashton wound up missing his third attempt, and Bryce was the champion. And I know that that's kind of a glossed over way of looking at it, but without going into lift by lift every single detail, that we leveraged lot number to our advantage and used that to force our opposition to pull after us and to take more weight than they needed. And so those are kind of three examples where you have these advantages that you can use to your favor. We're at lower level competitions, you know, that's not the objective. The objective at these lower level competitions, as we said, is gaining valuable experience, is becoming a better competitor, is hitting the personal best, because there's really no loss or decrement, if you will, for missing a PB. Whereas at a world championships, like you said earlier, Eric, if you miss a PB, you know, a shot of the PB, well, that might mean that you drop off the podium or that you drop placing, or instead of the gold medal, you're now silver. And so these are scenarios where it's important to try to leverage every advantage that you can into your favor.
You know, Matt, I am absolutely loving these examples. And, you know, you just can't get this from the scientific literature. You can get the relationship between how many lifts were made and placing. But to be an effective coach, it does also matter how you got there. And the strategy that you're discussing is how in these situations, for Susie versus Liz and for LS and so forth, and for Bryce, it matters how you got there. And this is why I think it's so important that we're including this here in Mass, is to get this insight to everybody. And I wrote down a couple things here. One, and to use kind of a golf analogy, is if you're watching, and then a side note, one of my favorite sports days of the year is Sunday at the Masters. But if you're watching, they'll say, so-and-so is in the clubhouse at 8 under. That individual might not be leading. Somebody else might be 9 under, but they have 3 holes to play. And anything can happen in those 3 holes. And what you talked about for LS is you wanted to put something on the bar that was a high probability make in his deadlift. It's not his lift. You didn't have any of the advantages. But your best chance was to get him in the clubhouse and put that number on the board. Other people had to see it. They knew they had to hit their lifts. Similar thing with Bryce. Although Bryce went last in his third, on his second, what he took and the fact that he was going last, his competitor had to take something more than he really needed because that lift was on the board for him. And so I think there's a lot to be said for that, to kind of, you know, be in the clubhouse with something on the board like that. And so I don't know. I have one other question for you, but I don't know if that makes sense to you and how you're referring to things, or if you have any other examples or anything else to add to that. But that's one of the things I took from some of those examples.
Yeah, no, I mean, what you said, Mike, it's a great example. You just, here's the situation. When you're in a position like LS was in, you want to force your competitor to go out on the platform and win the competition. Because if you miss your lift, then you've already lost. And so that's where it is truly about just building the total, about putting on the bar a high probability make. It might be less than the lifter wanted. It might be less than their all-time best, less than a PB, so be it. But it strategically positions them and forces your opposition. You know, this isn't football. There's not offense against defense. We're not calling plays and then you're strategically adjusting to my formation or the play that you think I'm going to call. It's me putting pressure on you, and the way that I put pressure on you is by making my attempt, by having my lifter make their lift, so that you then have to go. I don't care if you only have to go up by 2.5 kilos and that's 10 kilos under your PB. You still have to walk out on that platform. You could trip on the rug. You could get the bar could be covered in baby powder or something, or you could misgrip the bar. Or for these ultra wide sumo deadlifters where there's, you know, such a small margin for error, they're literally and figuratively walking that tightrope of performance. You know, they could miss. And so you want to force your competitor to make their attempt to beat you. Otherwise, you're essentially handing them the game. And so this all comes with the understanding also, you know, I can just, for 1 second, the data that I've looked at, the data reveal that 43.5% of lifters missed their third squat, 49% of lifters missed their third bench press, and 50, half, the lifters missed their last deadlift. So right there, just painting with broad strokes, almost half the competitors missed their third attempts. 24% of lifters miss both their third squat and their third deadlift. And as we said, those are the two attempts that affect the total the most. And so if you just focus on building a total, even if the thirds are lighter than what you'd hoped for, you're still probably outperforming half of the field. And so those are, you know, statistics that are worth taking to heart and understanding that you can win the game even when you are not matter-of-factly the strongest person in the room. Because powerlifting determines who is the best powerlifter, not who is the strongest.
That's a great way to look at it, right? The 16-0 Patriots and 73-1 Warriors, neither one of them won the championship. They were the best teams, but they didn't win the championship.
That's right.
Well said. And this, you know, as someone who has the privilege of working with some relatively high-level powerlifters, I've greatly appreciated your expertise. You mentioned how you worked with one of my lifters. And for those not super familiar with, I would say, modern powerlifting, where a lot of the most prominent, well-known, most experienced programming coaches don't happen to live in the same city as you as a lifter, because it's a niche sport. A common thing is you work with someone and have an online relationship. You know, you meet via video. They, you know, do your programming in a specific sheet. They might do your nutrition. They do a lot of things, and it is a great relationship, but it might be a challenge for that person to be there on game day. Especially if, say, they moved to New Zealand and the lifter is in the U.S., to give a personal example. So, you know, I've had the great pleasure and privilege of having a shared coaching relationship with you, with Bryce Lewis, where when he is competing at nationals, since 2015 or 2016, either you or Susie, but SSPT has been there to coach him. So I would love it if you could just talk a little bit about how you've shifted towards specializing in game day coaching, you and Susie, what you do at SSPT, how that's something that's available to a lot of people who are in the same position as myself. And then also for those who maybe aren't in a position to hire you as a game day coach, where they can learn more, as I know you have a recently released book on this topic.
Yes. So, just to discuss, I guess, what it is that we do, briefly who we are and our passion for game day coaching, you know, I kind of use the analogy that powerlifting is our game and our business is personal bests. And so our mission is matter-of-factly helping lifters become the strongest version of themselves, both on and off the platform. And so what that means for us on a day-to-day basis in person is we have a physical facility here in Bozeman, Montana, SSPT, which again is short for Supreme Sports Performance and Training, where it's a private facility where we do one-on-one coaching with powerlifters and, of course, general population as well, using the powerlifts to get them closer to their goals. But our passion, our absolute, what gets our motor running more than anything else is game day coaching for powerlifting. That is absolutely what lights our fire and what turns us on more than anything else. And so to your point, Eric, we've been blessed and just extremely grateful to work with lifters of all levels, from first-time novices who are competing at their very first local competition all the way up to elite-level lifters like Bryce Lewis and Mike Tushier at the World Games, which only happens every 4 years, and of course everything in between. And we've done that in both formats, raw and equipped, and that is what we absolutely love to do. And we've cultivated that passion through years of coaching on national teams and then of course doing this on an individual basis. So, you know, it's been an honor also to collaborate with you, you know, with Bryce. And like you said, we have this shared collaborative coaching experience where you're the guy, you know, with the recipe and you're cooking up the meal, and then we're kind of serving the meal, if you will, if you want to use that analogy on game day, where we matter-of-factly have to strategically get the most out of Bryce. And so, you know, on an individual basis, kind of how that looks, because we're not matter-of-factly side by side every lifter that we coach on game day, is like you said, strategically we have to watch their training. We have to collaborate with their programming coach should they have one. And then we get on these calls and we collaboratively install these game plans, working our way through each and every scenario that we think might pop up. And of course, there's going to be more scenarios at these higher level competitions where the talent pool is deeper, where the stakes are higher, where there are more opportunities for success, where maybe you can't win the competition, but you can procure an individual event medal or something like that. And so we have these strategy calls with lifters, and people also hire us just to do strategy calls where maybe we can't be there on game day, but maybe they just want our expertise in terms of collaborating with their coach. Maybe they just want a third set of eyes, if you will, to kind of collaborate. And so we've been blessed to have those opportunities as well. And so then more recently, what I decided to do, Eric, to mention, to piggyback off of what you mentioned, was I decided to take this 28 years of experience that I have and just package it up, if you will, and put it into written form. And so I decided to do that in an ebook format. And obviously, I owe a lot of that success to you, because as you know, I picked your brain on a number of consultation calls, and quite frankly, you led me to my editor and my formatter. And so God bless you for that, man, because I literally could not have done that without you. And that's just keeping it real and keeping it 100. You were extremely influential and instrumental in that process, and I'm forever grateful. And so I was able to create this ebook, which was the culmination of my cumulative, 28 years in the sport. And so I wanted to make it, the advantage that I had is scarcity in the marketplace. But while there's a lot of text and a lot of information out there on training systems, on training approaches, on nutritional perspective and so forth, there was virtually nothing in the marketplace that I was aware of in written or electronic format that you could go back and refer to. There were videos put out, but nothing in a tangible book form, if you will, on game day coaching for powerlifting. And so I decided to put that together. And fortunately, I think what I've done, and through the help of others such as yourself and Jason Tremblay and Mike Tushier and Kedvert Kwan, of course, who helped me with the making weight chapter and so forth, consulting with these other experts in the field, because literally and figuratively, throughout my tenure in the sport, I've been standing on the shoulders of giants in so many scenarios and situations, is I've been able to put together what I feel is a really comprehensive text that dives into, of course, like we talked about on this call and to your readers and your listeners, of course, the attempt selection and the strategy, but also delving into having a coaching philosophy and understanding the psychology that goes into dealing with lifters and understanding that we're not coaching robots, we're coaching humans. And so, and humans are emotional, and they're fallible, and they have wins and they have losses and they have other stresses in their life. And so I tried to create this text that I thought covered just every imaginable, touchstone point, if you will, within the sport of powerlifting, but specifically to game day coaching. And I understand that powerlifting is a niche sport, and then I'm a niche within that niche. And so, but I tried to create what I thought was the most comprehensive text that kind of covered all of the bases. So every imaginable thing that you might think about, from warming up to making weight to attempt selection and strategy in terms of how to formulate your game plan, how to put a warm-up plan together, how to pick your attempts, and everything in between, I tried to include that in one comprehensive text, and I think I've done that pretty well. And I'm excited, actually, next week to release an updated version of that, and that is going to be free to everybody who's already purchased a copy. And so they're going to get an updated version of that that is going to include 4 additional case studies. I think anytime you put together an instructional or how-to manual specifically for a sport, it is impossible to think of every single scenario that you're going to encounter. And so you write this book, and then you go to a competition, and you're like, ah, I have a scenario now that's staring me right in my face that I forgot to include. Let me include that. And then I realized, oh, but I've got the Arnold and I've got Sheffield that's coming up. So let me wait until the Arnold happens. Let me wait until Sheffield. And so my revisions were born out of those experiences. And so I've added about 6 pages of additional content to the book with 4 additional case studies, and adding additional layers of context to, again, what we started with at the beginning of today's discussion, this overarching theme of building your biggest total possible through 9 attempts and strategic attempt selection, and just positioning your lifter to succeed and become the best version of themselves, certainly off the platform, but of course in the context of powerlifting on the platform as well.
Matt, it's a couple things. One, you said you've stood on the shoulders of giants. I think we've all stood on your shoulders. I think you have.
Thank you for saying that.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's difficult for me to get up that high, but you know, you have impacted so many people, and you know, this is all very, very sincere. And I don't know, you know, I'm 37 years old now. Eric's 54, and so at this point, you know, we're familiar, and you know, we were starting in powerlifting at a certain time. But those that are just getting into powerlifting now, Matt, they may not know your name. And one of the things I've always admired about you is you weren't out for people to know your name. You were out to do the right things and to work hard and to make people's lives better. And but those that may have a coach now, your coach is probably somewhere in the lineage of Matt Gary. And, you know, anybody that I've coached or that Eric's coached has been influenced by you. And many of those people have gone on to coach other people. And that tree, it extends very far these days. And I think it's important to know that if you're hearing about attempt selection or these things, you know, I still use you and Susie's squat setup video to send to so many people when they're trying to learn to walk out. And, you know, these teachings extend to so many. So although you said you've stood on the shoulders of giants, I think so many of us have benefited and impacted from you. And so this next question is very sincere. We are not affiliates. We get nothing from this in any way. But where can people get your book?
Yeah, so probably the easiest way to find the Gamely Coaching Manual would be one of two places. You can find it on our website, which is supremesportspt.com. If you go under resources there, you're going to be able to find it under the ebook, the Game Day Coaching Manual. Or if you prefer on social media, you can just go to Instagram. You can find me at mlgary72, and the link is just in my bio. And so you just click on that, and that will direct you right to the page. And thank you again for your kind words, Mike. I think I'd be remiss if I said, you know, that was one of my intentions for writing the book, or my primary intention, was to lift up the powerlifting community. I understood that there was scarcity in the marketplace, as I said, and so let's put something out there that everybody can benefit from. Lifters of all levels and abilities, all goals, all objectives, regardless of competition, and of course their coaches. And so just use it as an instructional tool to put out there to lift up the community, obviously to leave something behind in terms of legacy. I have never had delusions of this becoming a New York Times bestseller. I mean, that's not what's going to happen with this book. Like I said, it's a niche within a niche. And so having said that, I'm not allergic to money. So it's nice to be able to make something from your efforts and from something that I've poured so much time and effort into. But more importantly, yes, it is an instructional manual, but it talks a lot about life, and it talks about a lot about how to conduct yourself, I think, in a way that is morally upright and is just and that serves the community well. And so if for no other reason that it helps you in that way, just become a better human being, then mission accomplished.
Love it. Thank you, Matt. And just as a final note, we've covered a lot of ground, but you are the expert here. Is there anything that you feel we have not covered in the realm of game day coaching that you want to make clear to our subscribers?
I think we've covered most of it, Eric. I mean, we really did touch upon a lot of things. I think at the most rudimentary level, what you have to understand as a coach is that it is your job to put your athlete, regardless of the endeavor. It could be, you could be a chess coach, you could be a golf coach, a powerlifting coach, gymnastics, it does not matter. It is to move your athlete and to put them in the best position to succeed, in the best position for them to achieve their goals. Not your goals, their goals. And so as you perpetuate down that road, you learn more about human beings, more about the human condition. And it's, like I said, it's about putting them in their best position to succeed. And that's going to look different for different people. But at the end of the day, and it is cliche, but if you've done that, if you've checked those boxes and you've put them in their best position to succeed, then you've matter-of-factly done your job, and it is incumbent upon them, and in this context, the lifter, to go out and execute. You know, because unfortunately, once they step onto the platform, you know, that's where your hands are no longer on the bar. You can't make the lift for them. But it is our job to do that. And so I think if you've done that, then you've fulfilled your primary role and objective as a coach and put them in their best position to succeed. You've done all they can, and hopefully they can thank you for that.
Well, with that, Matt, thank you for doing this. We are absolutely honored to not only have you in Mass, but to have you be the very first interview cover story. Thank you for what you've done for each of us here, and just what you've done as a broader support for the powerlifting community and for so many people that are out there today. I know a lot of people watching this have probably been impacted by you, and to be really remiss to not say by you and Susie for what both of you have done. So we're honored to have you. Thank you, sir.
Thank you again. And the feeling is entirely mutual. I love and respect you guys and what you're doing to lift up the community on your end as well. So thank you again very much.
Thanks, Matt.
Yeah, much appreciated.